Hello, and welcome to this FRDH First Rough Draft of History podcast. I'm Michael Goldfarb. The war in Ukraine has now entered its third year. Analysts who predicted a protracted conflict with the front line moving very little, as in World War I, have been proven right. Calls for Ukraine to accept the inevitable and seek terms with Russia have been direct, from the Vatican, and confusing, from Washington, where two separate foreign policies are being conducted, neither particularly helpful to the Ukrainian cause. The defeated candidate in 2020, through his control of the MAGA party in Congress, let's stop calling them the Republicans, has managed to stop funding for Ukraine's war effort, and the Biden administration has failed to provide the F-16s that might allow Ukraine to defend itself in the air. The administration has also put many red-line constraints on the country's military, which make it almost impossible for it to do more than maintain the battlefield status quo. We're in a lull before the summer fighting season as the country thaws and turns to mud, so while waiting for the next phase of the war to begin in earnest, it's a good time to explore again why Ukrainians remain committed to resisting the Russian onslaught. I decided to seek the opinion of one of the more interesting journalists covering the war, Vladislav Davidson.
I am an American citizen. I was born in Uzbekistan, in Central Asia. My grandparents fled Hitler from Ukraine and Belarus to Central Asia. They were evacuated.
Vladislav Davidson reports for Tablet Magazine, a Jewish weekly in New York. He's the author, most recently, of Jewish-Ukrainian Relations and the Birth of a Political Nation. The first part of the title indicates Davidson's view that Ukrainian territory is intimately connected to its Jewish citizens. Ukrainian territory was the heartland of Ashkenazic Jewry. But the last bit of the title is critical, because what the war is about is nothing less than a people giving birth to their political nation. Very rarely in the 21st century do we see the creation of a new nation-state. Ukraine has a long history, but not as an independent political entity, and watching this process unfold is not dissimilar to watching a new volcano break free of the earth in, say, Iceland. It is violent and awe-inspiring. To take the geological metaphor further, there is a tectonic tension in Ukrainian life, which is driving this nation's political birth, according to Davidson.
There's always been the tension between the two Ukraines, the Ukraine of everybody, the polyglot nation, the European-oriented, liberal, tolerant Ukraine, and the Ukraine of the titular nation, which is rebelling against some Russian or German or Polish overlord, right? Mostly in a futile manner. And there's this tension between these two Ukraines, both of which are, you know, legitimate and both of which provide part of its makeup, its cultural makeup. But the tension is the reason, I think, that the state survived in 2022, February of 2022 and March of 2022 during the Battle of Kiev, which, you know, the Russians could have won easily enough if things had gone in their favor, if their battle plan had been a little bit better, if they'd gotten a little bit luckier, if the Ukrainians had made bad decisions, if Ukrainians hadn't fought so well and so valiantly, they could have lost the Battle of Kiev. And I do believe that the Ukrainians won that battle, partly because of that incredible tension between the two Ukraines, the Ukraine of titular nationalism and the Ukraine of Ukrainians, the Ukrainian language and the symbols of the state and all that, and the Ukraine of everybody else living in Ukraine and tolerated it in Ukraine, also understanding, knowing full well the culture of the titular nation, but also being allowed to live freely and democratically and openly and in a noble fashion.
Davidson, despite his growing up years in America, finds himself more at home in Ukraine.
First of all, I feel very comfortable around Ukrainians in Kiev and Odessa and Kharkiv and Lviv. This is where my great parents and great grandparents and great great grandparents lived for a very long time. My family probably lived in these lands for 300, 400, 500, maybe 800 years, right? My people are from here. They have been living with Slavs, with Russians, Ukrainians, Poles, Belarusians for a very long time. I'm very comfortable in Eastern Europe. I'm an Eastern European in my head. I love Ukrainians. I love the Ukrainian political nation. I've spent 14 or 15 years now living in Ukraine on and off, and I'm very comfortable there. These are my people. This is the tenor of life, the emotional patterning of my world. When I argue with my mother or my sister, it is in a manner that would be intimately understandable to a Ukrainian or a Belarusian or a Russian or perhaps a Pole. The way that Ukrainians go to the cafe or to a restaurant or conduct their business affairs or their love affairs, this is infinitely understandable to me. I'm emotionally patterned it on these people. These are my people. I love them. So it's important for me that they like me and that they like my people, my other people, which is the Jews.
Listening to the author speak, you wouldn't know that he had great-grandparents killed in the Holocaust of bullets, those 18 months after the Nazi invasion of Ukraine in summer 1941, when more than 95% of the Jews who had not been evacuated to the east were shot, often with the help of local Ukrainian militias. One in four Jews murdered in the Holocaust were killed in Ukraine. It is this historical fact that colors many modern Jews' view of the present conflict and makes them skeptical about supporting Ukraine.
Yeah, I have run into that issue a lot. And there is a lot of residual bad memory and bad feeling, certainly in the diaspora. Sure. This is what defines a diaspora is memory. Diasporas live by memory. And American Jews from Kiev or from Moscow, from Minsk or Bobruisk or Lviv, they're Americans and they live to the extent that they're interested in these things through memory. They don't particularly, they don't. They'll not spend a quarter of their time in Kiev or Odessa like I will. They will have a different language. They'll have a different history. And in that way, it's understandable that British Jews are British and American Jews are American. Well, Russian Jews are Russian and Ukrainian Jews are Ukrainian, right? We're deeply embedded by we, I mean, Jews in the societies that we have made a life in. And it's difficult to explain to a Tunisian Jew the difference between Russian and Ukrainian Jews and Polish Jews, let alone life in Ukraine in 1941 and 2024. I say that because I have tried to explain that to Tunisian Jews who don't have any particular attachment to Ashkenazi culture, right? They listen very carefully and they try to understand, but there's just a lot of context. And so I get it why an American Jew or a Canadian Jew or a British Jew or even an Israeli would have a hard time understanding my particular commitment to this part of the world and to these people in this nation. I get that. And yet, I have to explain to them that what they're thinking about, that phenomenon, is a historical one. And the country that I know and the polis that I know could not be more liberal and democratically oriented and open to Jews and to minorities of all kinds than it is. It is amazing in many ways that the Ukrainian political nation at war has not degenerated into a blood and soil nationalism. It is very much a civic nationalism, right? Anyone who's born on the territory of Ukraine, as long as they think they're one of us, they're one of us, right? The blood and soil nationalism has not reared its ugly head for the most part in the middle of this conflict. Which is actually very surprising because that's what people do in the middle of a conflict. They burrow down into their personal relations and they become patriotic and nationalist and jingoistic, right? In that order. And that has not happened in this conflict. And partly, we have been able to avoid that kind of ethnic-based blood and soil nationalism on the Ukrainians' part because it's such an open nation, because it is led by a Jew. And someone whose head of presidential administration is a Jew and whose first defense minister is a Jew and a second defense minister is a Crimean Tatar Muslim, right? It's precisely because these people who are leading the country now are often from Russian-speaking families, often not of Ukrainian ethnic stock, that the country was able to survive the kind of divisive assault that the Russian state precipitated in February of 2022.
In 2012, I spent time in Lviv in western Ukraine. Svoboda, a neo-Nazi nationalist party, had come from nowhere to win seats in the national parliament and to take control of a number of local city councils in the western part of the country. I interviewed some of their leaders, and their unapologetic anti-Semitism was disheartening to hear. But now, Svoboda barely exists as a party, and the racism they preached is not a part of Ukrainian politics. So, what caused the change?
That's a great question. The change took place just because, the society's developed and become very mature over the last decade. The Ukrainian political nation has had to break away from post-Soviet habits of mind and certain bad Eastern European habits of mind as it's been developing a political nation and a state identity and state cohesion and state institutions and all that. And the Western-leaning disposition, dispensation, temperament, whatever you want to call it, that sort of process has brought forth, has nurtured the Ukrainian tolerance, which was always there. Ukraine has always had a great amount of tolerance for various reasons, and I mean for 300, 400 years. And there's always been bad things also, but not always. I believe that the society has ripened after after a revolution of dignity in 2014. I believe the fact that it was liberal and inclusive and socially inclusive, anyone who wanted to be part of it, that led to a great deal of solidarity, right? There was no racial, ethnic, Ukrainian ethnic nationalism. It was civic nationalism in the Maidan.
The Revolution of Dignity, the civic uprising against the government of Viktor Yanukovych, took place in Maidan Square in central Kiev in late 2013 and early 2014. It is for Ukrainians what the battles of Concord and Bunker Hill are for Americans. More than 100 people were killed. It was the founding skirmish that defined the modern Ukrainian nation. Oddly, the violence had the effect of returning Jews to national life.
The fact that Zelensky was a Jew or of Jewish descent was of no importance whatsoever during the 2019 election that brought him to power. It didn't matter to anybody. And he didn't really lean into his being Jewish until 2022 when he asked the world to say no to this horrific Kremlin propaganda about Nazis and denazification, right? It did not matter in 2019, and it didn't particularly matter in terms of Ukrainian internal politics until 2022, or even external politics, really. He did not lean into his Jewish identity until the war began, at which point he went on TV and he said, in so many words, "My grandfathers were not Nazis, they fought in the Red Army, and also some of them were in the concentration camps." He said this openly in Russian to Russian speakers on Russian television so that they could say no to this terrible war and to the pretext of this terrible war of denazification, right? He didn't actually say I'm Jewish on TV, but he said my great grandparents and great grandparents, they died for the Red Army and in the Nazi concentration camps. And he did lean into his Jewish identity because of the war when he pled with the Knesset in Israel for support, or when he toured the world's Jewish communities or Jewish leaders asking for their help. And so, that is a remarkable example of secular leadership being very Jewish, but it's not the only thing that's important. The country was very hospitable to Jews for a very long time. The one thing that you could say about all six presidents of Ukraine since 1991 was that none of them were anti-Semites. None of them had any state-backed anti-Semitic policies. Whatever else, they're failures, and they all had a lot of failures. They were not anti-Semites, right? There was no state-backed anti-Semitism in Ukraine since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Just the opposite, a lot of Philo-Semitism and warm relations from the state to its population. So, which is, historically very difficult to understand if you're a British Jew or a Jew in Milwaukee or Florida whose parents ran away from the Cossacks 120 years ago, right?
Official anti-Semitism was the rule throughout the Soviet Union in the years after World War II. The fact that it did not continue in Ukraine after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991 is important. Davidson's family suffered from this state-imposed discrimination, and I wondered how the experience shaped his life.
That's a great question. How did it shape my own life? Well, my parents don't have very much Jewish culture.
Upon arriving in the U.S. in 1991, his parents tried to initiate him in that culture.
I was in Jewish summer camp, and I met Jews from suburban places in Long Island and upstate New York and Teaneck, New Jersey, and the Bronx, the nice parts of the Bronx. That was my kind of assimilation into American Jewish life. But because my parents were so secular, they didn't know anything. The Soviet Union inculcated materialism in both senses of materialism, a philosophical materialism, as a way of life and thought into all of its citizens, and demanded that internal or private life dissolve itself of anything like religion or belief in God or civic association. And the fact that the state monopolized all relations, it had to repress Jewish life as it repressed Muslim life and Christian life and Orthodox life. But in the cases of other minorities who were not Jewish, it was easier for them to regain their national self-awareness because they still had their language and their culture. Whereas repressing religion amongst Soviet Jews, it repressed the culture also. And by my parents' generation, by the time they're born in the late 50s, early 60s, they have no Jewish particularity or particular culture to speak of. So they had very little to nothing to pass along to their kids. That entire generation of my parents' cohort, they know nothing about Judaism except the Holocaust. Zero Jewish culture. They don't know languages. They don't know Jewish stories. They don't know the Bible. They don't know culture. They don't know the background, anything really. And so by the time they get to America, even though they're fumbling around to do something, 90% of them and of their cohort are not able to pass on along to their kids anything in terms of actual Jewish culture. So to the extent that I have Jewish culture, and I do, I had to go forth and find it myself by taking classes in college and reading a lot on my own and going to engage in Jewish institutional life in America without their prodding. My sister knows nothing, and my cousins know nothing except that they are Jewish. And that's the case with most secular Jews from a Russian-speaking post-Soviet world.
Davidson grew up in Brighton Beach, the section of New York City nicknamed Little Odessa, where Soviet Jews who were able to leave Russia in the late 70s and early 80s settled. Before I left New York for London in late 1985, I used to go to Brighton Beach from time to time, on hot days to swim, but mostly to try and connect with the food culture I grew up with and indulge in a little nostalgia for my grandparents' generation. They too were immigrants from Ukraine, although when they left, the country was split between the Austro-Hungarian and Russian empires.
It's changed a lot since I was a kid down there. It really changed a lot. And I noticed that when I go back, it's become a lot more Ukrainian in every sense. It's become more Ukrainian Jewish or just more Ukrainian. You hear a lot more Ukrainian spoken in Brighton Beach than I did when I was a kid. You hear it everywhere. There are Ukrainian flags everywhere. And there are Ukrainian stores, and there's just a lot more Ukrainian Jewish life than there was. And a lot of a Russian-speaking Jewish life has rebranded itself as Ukrainian because obviously no one wants to be affiliated with what Putin is doing, you know. And it's also become a lot more Central Asian, which is very odd for my mother since she was born in Uzbekistan, and Central Asia followed her to Brighton Beach. It's become a lot more Georgian and Central Asian. There are a lot more Uzbeks, Tajiks, Kazakhs, Azerbaijanis. In that way, it's a lot more post-Soviet. It really feels a lot more like a post-Soviet splinter state than it does like a Ukrainian-Russian or Russian or Russian Jewish state when I was a kid.
I was first in touch with Vladislav Davidson when I made a program in 2018 for the BBC about reviving Jewish life in Ukraine. He was editing a magazine called Odessa Review. I wondered how he had got interested in that magical city.
My relatives are from that part of Ukraine, and I have a relative who's a very famous composer, my great-great uncle Isaac Dunayevsky, and he wrote a theme song to Odessa. Odessa, Odessa, right? So I always had this sense of Odessa, and everyone I knew growing up was from Odessa. 80% of the kids that I were growing up was growing up with in Brighton Beach were Odessan Jews.
And while we're talking about Odessa, what is the current situation there?
It's terrible. It's simply terrible. It's Odessa's under attack. Odessa's been under attack continuously from Russian cruise missiles and Shahed 126 drones since the start of the war. But for about a year, while there was a deal in place between Kiev and Moscow on the grain exports, there was no attacks in Odessa, and that deal served as a de facto insurance policy for the port and for the beautiful city center. After the Russians scuppered that deal last summer and the Ukrainians counter attacked the Russian Black Sea fleet very skillfully, by the way, sinking a third of it, 25, 26 Russian ships out of 75, 76 have been destroyed or damaged beyond repair. The Russians have been bombing mercilessly to the extent that they can get away with it. And that, again, insurance policy, which protected the city, is gone. So the Russians continuously bomb the city and kill people all the time.
How does Davidson see the coming fighting season?
Obviously, the Ukrainians are in a much worse situation than they were a year ago. The counter failure, the counter offensive, vaunted counteroffensive did not have the effects it had. A lot of material and men have been spent on both sides. But the Russians are doing much better than they were 6 months ago by any indicator, except on the Black Sea. And obviously the Ukrainians are in a defensive position. The Russians have been doing much better at carpet bombing. The drone revolution is upon us. And the Ukrainians' secondary defense lines are not as good as we would like them to be. If they're not very deep, those secondary defense lines, the Russians can very well, destroy the Ukrainian army by death through a thousand cuts, right? We're not at the point yet where the Ukrainian army is at the point of even talking about, breaking at any given one point. But with enough pressure, the Ukrainian army could fold, which is why the Americans and the Europeans really need to step up help assistance, which they've dropped the ball on. The situation is markedly worse than it was 6 months ago. Markedly worse, not critically worse, not existentially bad, but things are not going in the right direction. While they are going in the right direction for the Russians, who are mobilizing hundreds of thousands of men and are regenerating their fighting power correctly and easily. And I'm a positive optimistic that we'll win in the long term, but in the medium term, one should be more pessimistic, I'm sad to say.
Vladislav Davidson, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be on with you.
And that's all for this FRDH podcast. My thanks again to Vladislav Davidson for making time to speak with me. And a reminder, there is now a first rough draft of history Substack. It's worth a visit. And while there, you can make a donation so I can continue to do this work. Thanks.